Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Emma Powell. How are you doing, Emma?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Good. And we're going to be talking about Bob Diamond in a minute, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right.
Everyone's favourite banker.
Yeah.
And Bradley Gerrard, how are you, Bradley?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
Yeah, I noticed the beer's gone a bit absent.
Yeah, we were discussing this earlier. Yeah, I accidentally set my razor to a lower setting than I realised. I'm blaming my 15-month-old daughter for distracting me momentarily for the accident that was trimming my beard on about number 3 as opposed to number 7 on my razor.
You're undermining the beard culture of the Investors Chronicle. Anyway, let's crack on. I'm sure our readers don't want to hear about facial hair. It's been a funny week. It doesn't seem to be as news-ridden as it has in recent weeks, but quite an interesting section anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you say that. There's obviously the big US tech giants have been reporting this week, which has caused a bit of a flurry.
Oh, yeah, Apple.
Yeah, Apple. Yeah, the Apple has fallen slightly from the tree, so to speak. I mean, it had to happen at some point. I mean, you can't go on selling more and more and more products year after year after year without any, you know, slowdown eventually.
We've been here before. Feels like we've been here before.
Yeah, well, in effect, we're living what people were expecting. So a few months ago, there was the expectation that this would happen. The reality has, you know, well, that expectation has come true and become reality. It did hit the shares a fair bit yesterday.
Yeah. I read today that one analyst is calling for Tim Cook's head now and the heads of several other executives as well. And
yeah, I mean,
innovation is gone. And it just feels so familiar. It just feels like such a typical view on Apple.
Yeah, it does. I mean, people are saying that, you know, Apple needs to do something really, really radical now and that sort of thing. And
well, I hear they're making cars.
The reality is they probably are doing lots of radical things that maybe just aren't quite ready for market yet. And you could argue, I mean, things like their wearables hasn't quite gone as well as they hoped. But I mean, you know, the iPhone has been a remarkable product. And I think for people to kind of call for the king's head, so to speak, on this result is a bit unnecessary, really. I mean, yes, the level of sales has fallen, but for them not to have done so for such a long time is quite a remarkable achievement, really. And given the strength of the balance sheet as well, I mean, it's not going to go anywhere anytime soon.
No, that's true. But then I guess if they go X growth, there'll be more calls to return some of that cash. And you know, they are returning cash in the form of dividends now,
exactly.
Buybacks. And
also, if there is that call, they've got the power to do it.
Power to do it, absolutely.
They have the power to become X growth, should they wish so.
I mean, let's talk about cars, because that's a new spotlight this week. And yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, think about Apple, you know, if they are working on something disruptive in the automotive space, then, you know, this is more bad news for the automotive sector, which, reading this again, is more bad news coming out of the car manufacturers.
Yeah, absolutely it is. I mean, obviously VW was the kind of notable example that kind of set this recent flurry of news off around the car industry surrounding their emissions tests, which had effectively been sort of, well, fakes and effects of doctors, whichever word you want to use.
VW, we knew that, though.
Yeah, we knew that. Yeah, but I'm saying that's what was the start of this. And obviously, more recently now, we've had other companies kind of fall foul of this. So a big one actually is in is Mitsubishi Motors, which has admitted that actually the way in which it tests its cars has been flawed since 1991.
And this it was fuel efficiency, wasn't it, problems here?
Yeah, it's all around fuel efficiency, emissions. So all of these claims that you know, are used often to sell cars, it seems in a large proportion of the industry are actually not that true. Or where you have sort of cases where, I mean, General Motors is kind of, you know, saying that actually it's not done anything wrong, you know, everything's fine. I mean, I guess that might well be the case, but it's a reputational thing that's kind of hitting all the car manufacturers now, especially in light of Mitsubishi. And yeah, as you say, I mean, this coupled with the potential for tech companies to start, you know, launching, I don't know, driverless cars or whatever. I mean, if this emission stuff is still going on in a few years' time, you'd have to maybe start to worry about the sector as a whole, potentially. Obviously, not on a very long-term view, but
I do like driving. I don't like driving, you know, because most of it involves being stuck in traffic. But I do like when I'm actually behind the wheel to have control of that wheel.
Yeah.
So the driverless thing, yeah, that leaves me a bit cold. But something like I'd love it. The new Teslas look fantastic.
Well, exactly. I think we're probably a very long way off of electric cars being the dominant vehicle on our roads. That said, actually, something else we did sort of mention in the news section, in the little numbers section, was that Germany's moved to launch this like 1 billion euro subsidy for the sale of electric cars. So that's kind of a move by Germany to subsidise and help its own car industry, which is obviously very important in Germany, against the sort of likes of Tesla and those sorts of people who are potentially going to be muscling in on, you know, car consumers' desires. So that kind of ties into this story as well. So, I mean, a very, very long-term view stuff, this, I suppose, you know, the fear of driverless cars on the conventional car. But it's something that a lot of people are thinking about. And, you know, the fact that we have seen now tests of driverless cars on roads, there's been tests of commercial freight lorries as well, I think, in Europe. You know, it's not miles and miles and miles away that they'll become more common.
No, I'm sure I saw a headline. I'm sure someone was talking this week about it not being too far away that in central London, actually, most of the cars become self-driving before very long at all.
Yeah.
I saw a fantastic headline in the FT this week on the subject of the importance of Germany's car industry to their economy. Driving Miss Merkel. I thought it was amazing. A really great headline. I wish I thought of that myself.
That is genius.
I thought it was absolutely brilliant. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, fascinating stuff that, you know, Germany, the dominant car player in Europe, is now perhaps seeing which way the wind is blowing here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very interesting. The fact that the government has moved to launch this kind of subsidy is very, very interesting. And, you know, as I said, if the scandals against the conventional car manufacturers keep unfolding, and sentiment keeps, you know, being sort of driven against them, then, you know, it's potentially a very sort of dangerous situation. I mean, as Daniel Alberto says at the end of the piece, if you're brave right now, you could probably pick up some car manufacturer shares for a very cheap price. But the danger is that regardless of whether that company you buy is the subject of another scandal, might not be sort of relevant. It might just be impacted by a rival being subject to a scandal. I mean, it's just so, the shares will just sort of potentially domino. You know, if we have another VW or another Mitsubishi, the sentiment towards car manufacturers generally is likely to sour, even if it's in the short term.
I mean, you could always buy a Tesla. They're very expensive, but
yeah,
you know, we had at one of our events last year, we had Scottish Mortgage Trust presenting. I'm sure you know them well, Bradley.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was really surprised. This is really ancient, is perhaps the wrong word. It's been around quite some time, Scottish Mortgage. I mean, you know, it's probably a century old.
At least, yeah, it's more than that.
And, you know, one of their biggest holders is Tesla. Mm. They go for these very disruptive companies. They're buying more. The shares are expensive. But, you know, they see the disruption that this company could cause. And you look at the gigafactory that's built out in Nevada?
Yes, Nevada. Yeah, I think that's right.
Nevada?
Yep.
Oh, is it Arizona? Can't remember.
They're next to each other, I think.
Next to each other. Desert, yeah. Somewhere. You know, this company really has gone from being a sort of interesting technology company to something that is becoming mass market.
And, yeah, I mean, it's coming beyond the quirk, as you say. And actually, I was reading something the other day about the fact that it does have quite demanding sort of targets to hit in terms of its business for, you know, Elon Musk, the owner, to kind of get paid the amount that he does. So in terms of, you know, sort of corporate governance, I suppose, which is a big issue at the moment in markets, you know, Tesla does kind of set quite high benchmarks and goals for itself. So I guess maybe that's partly something that Scottish mortgage managers like about it, is that, you know, yes, it's still in its disruptive stage and it's a long way off from being, you know, on the scale of conventional car manufacturers, but its discipline, I suppose, in management could eventually lead it to become that.
Well, we all like Elon Musk.
Who doesn't?
He's the archetypal manager that we all want managing.
He's like a film really character or something.
He was in a film. He was in Iron Man 2, I think it was.
That's great movie trivia.
Why is it my weekends when I'm not doing house clearance and decorating? There you go. All right, Bradley, what else have we got in the news section?
Theron Mohammed, our you know, sort of technology and media correspondent, had a look at some of the recent, very recent updates from some of the media groups. And a big trend is the hit on advertising spend in the UK. It's potentially a short-term thing. You have sort of obviously the football championships in the summer, which could help some companies. But yeah, we had STV, ITV and Wireless all suffer from sort of declines in advertising. And Trinity Mirror and Daily Mail and General Trust, again, hit by reductions in print advertising. Both of those companies, the two latterly mentioned, blaming in particular supermarkets as one industry that's advertising a lot less now. Maybe that's linked to the sort of deflationary environment they find themselves in. Maybe it's also linked to the fact that there's a lot of pressure on the way in which they can promote their deals, that sort of thing. I mean,
what about Brexit? I mean, we, you know, this is something we here are experiencing too. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Big financial services companies, uncertain about what the outcome of the referendum is going to be, are putting their spending plans on hold in terms of marketing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very legitimate reason that could be part of the fall in advertising. I mean, you know, if you're not sure what's going to happen, then the best thing is to hunker down, I suppose, and that's probably what a lot of advertisers are doing.
So possibly not the best time to be in the media sector.
No, possibly not. I mean, obviously there is the flip side of it is, if you're, well, as a newspaper group, the flip side is online, but obviously you have to make sure that as an investor, you're paying attention to the, you know, is the decline in print advertising being outstripped by the growth in online?
So you need to sort of... Is the short answer.
Well, exactly, yeah. No. I'm just saying that's what people need to look at. It's not really the moment. We're a little away from that, but the pace at which, I guess, like a media publishing house can grow its online sort of advertising revenue is probably going to be a quite key factor in the coming years.
I mean, paid content, you know, if I was looking at the media sector as an analyst, which I'm not, but I look at it as the editor of a magazine, you know, it's paid content that you want to be involved in. You know, if I were looking at companies, I'd want them to have that cushion of paid content, because advertising is notoriously cyclical.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess the potential problem with that is when you look at something like the Times, and I mean, you know, they still have their paywall up, so one presumes it must still be working to a degree.
But the Sun took theirs down.
Exactly, because I guess the problem with more generalist sort of media is that their content is very similarly available on lots of free sites. I mean, I guess you could argue... I guess the paid for content would have you a bit more specialist, I suppose.
Yeah, well, or Game of Thrones.
Or
because I've done something this week that I vowed never to do, and that was to give money to Rupert Murdoch, and I haven't gone the whole hog and bought a Sky subscription, but I have signed up for a 6-month entertainment pass on Now TV.
It's a slippery slope, John.
Don't you know, for 6 seasons, I have waited a year for the DVD to come out. I just couldn't wait this season.
Well, don't tell me anything
about what's going on with Jon Snow?
I don't know. I'm a few seasons behind, so no spoilers, all right?
All right, I'll keep quiet then. Emma, let's talk Bob Diamond. Atlas Mara, which for me is a company that I barely knew existed, I have to say.
Yeah, it floated a few years ago. Well, it's kind of a combination between Bob Diamond's Atlas Merchant Capital, which is a US-based kind of investment company, and then also the Mara Group, which is owned by a Dubai-based entrepreneur, Ashish Thakkar. Their whole kind of strategy is that they want to acquire African banks and become this kind of pan-African financial services company.
Okay, so first question, why on earth is this listed in London?
Yeah, good question.
I mean, a US merchant bank, an African banking group,
yeah,
headed by Bob Diamond, who's not exactly, you know, the flavour of the city.
Well, no. Yeah, that's a good question, to be honest. I mean, its shares have not done well. They actually had results yesterday, which were... They were all right. It's very thin on the ground, though.
We didn't cover them,
no, because, again, that was a kind of decision by Ian, our company's editor, because there just wasn't enough there of substance in the results, because they're in such early stages of making these acquisitions. They've acquired... some of the acquisitions they've made are a bank in Rwanda, a bank in Zambia... Well, I think that's it, actually. I think they own something in Nigeria. It's really early days. But obviously, the big news is their latest, what they've got their eyes on at the moment, which is Barclays
African assets.
Yeah, well, the Barclays have the, it's like 62.something% stake in Barclays Africa. And that's what they confirmed yesterday, that they were in discussions to acquire that.
Okay, so presumably Bob Diamond knows these assets quite well.
Well, yeah.
Is this good for Barclays?
I mean, it's part of their strategy. You know, they're selling off all their non-core assets. So, I mean, I guess it depends what price they can get for it. But this has been flagged for a long time with Barclays, that they're they're concentrating on their core assets. They're getting rid of, you know, a lot of their European retail operations, the African stuff, and the whole their reasoning is that they just want to prevent things like Barclays Africa from dragging on the core operations. Although, interestingly, Barclays Africa was actually quite a high-returning business.
Yeah, I mean, this is weird. So Barclays Africa, drag on returns, and yet Bob Diamond thinks that there is a fundamental key to unlocking the value in Africa within the Atlas Mara Group. So, I mean, a bit weird.
A bit weird.
A bit of a contradiction there.
A bit weird, but could be, you know, one of the biggest acquisitions they've made. It could set them off, you know.
So this might make Atlas Mara more interesting enough to actually bother covering.
Yeah, I mean, it's 300 million market cap, so it is above our traditional threshold, but there just wasn't enough substance in the results to actually judge it, you know, enough, but because it is still early days. But, I mean, next year, who knows, and it'll definitely be one we keep an eye on, especially if they acquire Barclays Africa.
And Barclays, which I guess is the reason we've written this story, Bradley.
Mm. Yep.
We still like the shares.
Yeah, we've still got them on a buy tip. They had Q1s actually yesterday. And, you know, the headlines were that profits were down during the first quarter compared to last year. It's not really a surprise. But actually, they were kind of moving in the right direction. A lot of it was because it had a negative income for their non-core businesses. We kind of knew that was going to happen. Pre-tax loss for non-core, we knew that was going to happen. But actually, the core business was increasing its returns. So, yeah, we think we're keeping with the kind of long-term recovery play there.
Yeah, not been a great tip, but stick with it.
Well, that's just like so many of the financial services at the moment, you know?
Yeah, I guess Brexit's dragging on that. The uncertainty around what's going to happen in the referendum. Mm. But hey, you know, let's see what happens. Who knows? Okay, thank you, Emma. This week's cover feature is part two of the AIM 100. We spoke about it the first 50 and actually a preview of the second 50 because Simon was here and he's tipped a few of them. But let's talk, Bradley, about some of yours in this week's final 50, the biggest 50 companies on AIM. What are your highlights of the top 50?
I guess one is Fever Tree Drinks.
We always talk about Fever Tree. I'm sure we talked about it last week.
I think we talked about it after the podcast. I'm hoping that's the case.
No, I'm sure we talked about it on the podcast.
Do we?
Maybe it was another podcast. Maybe it's just my obsession with gin and tonic.
Maybe. So. I'll be very quick then, in case last week we did talk about it.
I'm sure we did.
I think we talked about it afterwards. But anyway, the shares have done very, very well. I recently moved it back to a hold just because I'm a bit unsure about whether it can keep going. Although a big part of me thinks that it probably could. But the rating now is just very, very expensive. Yes. But that said, it doesn't really have a rival at the moment. And
it does. I've told you this before.
Okay, you buy Tesco.
Tesco's own brand, cucumber-infused diet gin.
Well, maybe that's a dark horse and not everyone else is aware of yet. And maybe it's going to be the nemesis of Fever Tree. But at the moment, that's certainly not the case.
Okay.
It's a good business. There is clear demand from institutional investors for the shares, which could kind of help the share price in the near future, because the two, the chairman and the chief executive own a fairly large slug of the company still. They have recently offloaded some shares given demand from fund management houses and the like. So yeah, I like that one. We've got that on hold mainly because of a rating thing, but I think I can't think of an analyst who's that bearish on it, actually. Everyone's pretty bullish on it.
Let's talk bananas.
Vice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a tip of my predecessor, Julia Bradshaw, I believe. We kind of thought that after its failed kind of merger with Chiquito, that it would probably be snapped up by somebody else. That actually hasn't transpired. And the poacher turned gamekeeper, so to speak. So Vice has been buying up other companies. It's been getting in on the M&A action itself, acquiring things rather than being acquired. And it's working out pretty well, actually. I mean, the fruit produce market is quite fragmented. Like, yes, you have some very big companies alongside Fife's, like Chiquito's and Del Monte, but below that is quite a fragmented market and creates sort of opportunities for people like Fife to buy up sort of smaller players.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's a good company.
I like the look of it. And that's on a buy.
Yep.
Patisserie is an interesting one. Posh cake shops. I mean, it's kind of a touch of the Fever Trees about it.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you're exactly right, really. It kind of, it's definitely of a time, I think. And I think for me personally, just my kind of personal taste that time was probably a few years ago. But yeah, I mean, the management team came in, did very, very well, and they've really caught fairly early on, I'd probably say, that this sort of desire of people to spend quite a lot of money on coffee and cake. But now I just think that the competition from sort of the growing number of independent shops and that sort of thing are just a bit of a challenge to it potentially. I mean, you know, I can't see, as we say in the piece, I mean, it's trading on 27 times forward earnings. I can't see that being sustained for too long. I mean, I just really wonder. But I mean, I looked at some of the recent sort of share movements in it, and there are fund managers upping their stakes. But likewise, Old Mutual actually dropped its stake to below 7% of the company. So,
but people do like stopping off for coffee and cake.
They do.
It's Luke Johnson, the entrepreneur, who's behind this. This is the guy that turned Pizza Express into this huge brand across the UK. I mean, he's done it before.
Yep.
Yeah, lots of pizza companies out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's managed to create something there and, you know, he knows what he's doing.
Absolutely. There's no doubting that. Just for me, I just think there's so much competition now for this market of like cake and coffee. I mean, it's everywhere. And the growing number of kind of almost craft like coffee producers. I mean, maybe it's a slightly more London centric thing than countrywide thing. But yeah, I just think there's an awful lot of choice out there. And you've got things like companies like Tesco backing, you know, growing chains like Harrison Hall.
Well, that's their own chain, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you just kind of think, well, if that model continues and you have very big retail players kind of buying up or launching these sort of brands or effectively posh coffee and cake shops, and you kind of wonder how long Patisserie Holdings is going to stay as pricey as it is, and able to keep going in terms of the share price.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, they're nice shops, and I think where they're based, probably a lot of footfall is probably tourist football, especially in London.
People love the security of a brand.
They
being do. Able to walk into a shop that they've heard of, and you know, you can't overestimate the power of that.
It's true.
My family can't walk past the cake shop without going in there, so you know.
But does it have to be?
Just like I can't walk past the pub without going.
We all have our vices,
indeed. I mean, you know, I look at this top 50, and you know, AIM has a reputation for being a kind of speculative paradise for oil and gas and mining explorers. But actually, this top 50, a lot of it is very consumer focused.
Yeah,
a lot of brands that we know.
Absolutely. I mean, another one of mine is Young & Co Brewery. I mean, it's been around for frequented a few of their outlets.
Absolutely.
you know, it's been around for years, this pub group, and you know, they're about to have a change of chief executive, but you know, the ale pump, I suppose, is being handed somebody who's been at the business quite a long time, has a lot of experience. So there's no sort of reason to be worried there.
No.
But yeah, as you say, I mean, it's, you know, Young & Co isn't a speculative investment. Yes, it's potentially cyclical and geared into the consumer sentiment.
To a degree.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not cyclical,
but that's not,
in the sense
not,
of,
yeah,
you know,
it's not
boom
speculative.
Or bust.
No, exactly. No.
But, you know, you've got Apple Green, which does petrol stations. You've got Majestic Wine, which I'm sure most of our readers would have heard of. You've got Pinewood movie studio.
Yeah,
been around for a long time. Pretty important in its industry. I mean, it's
favourite Nichols.
Nichols, my favourite. Conviviality sells cheap booze. Never been in one, but might do in the future. No, it's amazing, really amazing. Mulberry posh handbags.
Yeah,
it's incredible. It really doesn't tally with the image that AIM has among certain, that is projected by certain people.
So, I guess this is a select pick of the AIM market, which is vast.
The biggest companies on the AIM market.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the AIM market is vast, and actually to really look at the AIM index as like you would the FTSE 100 is almost kind of not really.
But there's no one that tracks it. There's no product that tracks
it. No, exactly.
I think
you can't. Yeah, it is sensible. You can't really do it because of that. So it is very much a stock picker's market. And I guess that's where you get sort of some comments whereby they look at the whole thing and think, gosh, look at the performance of that. But
or they look at one thing and tar all companies are named with the same brush.
Well,
which
yeah,
I think is equally naive.
It is, yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, I guess like any market really, but particularly, I mean, it is a stock picker's market. And as you said, there are some very well known, not that obscure companies on there. Mm. And if there are obscure ones, then you know there's a potential they could do very well as well. And I mean, there are some fund managers who focus on AIM who do very, very well.
Well, Gervais Williams.
Gervais, yeah. There's the guys at Marlborough, Giles Hargreave.
Yeah.
Backed ASOS for an incredibly long time and did remarkably well out of that.
And of course, you had Britain's first ISA millionaire, Lord Lee.
Yeah.
Who's done very, very well out of AIM indeed. And of course, you get all the tax benefits to go with it now.
AIM. Exactly. And Woodford as well. I mean, he fishes in the AIM market a bit as well as unquoted, but, you know.
Indeed. Indeed. Right, so Emma, you've also got a couple of companies in the second half of our AIM 100 feature.
Yeah.
Highlights for you. What are your favourites this in the top 50?
One company sticks out for me. That's Burford Capital. They're quite an interesting company. Obviously, I just covered them for the first time for their results a few weeks ago. And it's quite obvious to everyone that the US is becoming increasingly litigious. And what Burford Capital do is they kind of lend money to, it might be like a law firm or it might be a company. If they don't have, you know, the funds, obviously litigation is very costly and can drag on for years, that they kind of take on those cases. And the returns are quite, they can be quite long dated. So they're still making returns on cases or portfolios of cases that they took on in 2009. I think they made the ones in 2009 last year, you know, it was over 200% return on those, on that, the credit that they had put against those cases. So they're really unusual. I've not come across a company like this before. They've done astronomically well, the shares.
Mm.
They're up about 95% over the past 12 months.
Yes, they were Simon Thompson's favourite. Simon Thompson was on last week and was speaking in glowing terms about Burford Capital.
Yeah, it's a buy tip, actually. 136% up on the buy tip in 2014.
Lovely.
So
lovely.
Yeah, very good.
Lovely. Keep the legal cases rolling on, America.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, what else? You've got Secure Trust Bank, which we've liked for a long time,
yep.
But back to hold.
Back to hold, yeah. It's on about 3.6 times price to book, which is so expensive compared to the rest of the sector, the rest of the challenger banks. You've got Virgin Money, I think it's on about 1.1 times. The rest of the challenger banks are kind of between 1 and 2 times. So, again, it's done really well and its loan book is growing a lot, but I think a lot of that has just been priced in because it's so expensive now, but good to hold.
We prefer Arbuthnot now, which has a big stake in Secure Trust, don't we?
Yeah, Arbuthnot, and they're expanding their kind of commercial banking business. So I think Arbuthnot kind of, there was a propensity for it to be kind of overlooked in favour of its of Secure Trust Bank, but actually I think that's one definitely to keep an eye on, which is a lot cheaper too. So
absolutely. Plus 500 is another notable one because obviously they had a terrible year last year with some regulatory troubles. Have we changed our view on them? Are we bullish yet?
Do you know what, actually writing this, I was getting more bullish. Right, obviously they had all the, you know, the compliance issues, which they incurred heavy costs last year on kind of switching up their compliance and taking on more staff and that kind of thing, and also in marketing, you know, marketing their services and trying to get customers back in. But actually the shares have recovered quite sharply. I mean, obviously they're nowhere near what they were before they had all these problems at the start of last year, but I don't know, like, you know, apart from the costs last year, the figures did all look good, actually. But I think it's a question of trust.
Yeah.
Whenever you have an industry as heavily regulated as financial services, whenever you have any kind of compliance issue, it takes a long time for people to kind of have investors and customers, obviously, to have faith again.
But it didn't turn out to be quite the Quindell some people expected it to be.
Oh, no. It was nothing on that scale.
But there was for a while, suspicions that it might go that way. And, you know, to get through that, and the the negative sentiment associated with that, there must be something more to this business.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it was around documentation that they held for some of their client accounts. And, yeah, unsurprisingly, like you said, people did think it was a Quindel kind of scenario, and the shares went off a cliff. I mean, it was drastic. But they've changed their compliance processes. They've sorted that out. The shares have recovered quite well. So, I mean, we've got it on a hold at the moment because we did switch it. It was actually an active buy tip, I think, when it happened.
Yeah, of course it was.
And we went straight to sell. We went straight to sell, but then I put it back up to a hold during the last results because actually I don't think you can ignore how, you know, it's customer before it kind of had to freeze it, taking on new customers, how well it was doing and how well it seems to be kind of recovering now. So I do think it's one to hold.
Well, it's essentially an Israeli software business.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen those, Bradley, you'll know this, in the gambling space, companies like Playtech. And, you know, there's long been, you know, criticism of them as being a bit black box. You don't really know what's going on within there, but they've never really run into trouble in the way that people expected them to.
No, exactly. I think, as Emma says, I mean, Plus 500 had its troubles with, information about his clients, but I think actually from memory, because I covered this a little bit before you took it on, Emma, I think they did actually sort of hold their hands up to the FCA. I think that was what they said in one of their regulatory announcements, if I remember rightly. So, and yeah, the spread betting market is quite kind of fragmented, so I think Plus 500 is probably likely to make some more bolt-on acquisitions and hopefully from there kind of maybe gather back that kind of critical mass of customers that it's had for quite a long time.
Well, one of the big gambling firms tried to buy them, didn't they?
Yes, that was Playtech, wasn't
it? Playtech, it was Playtech. Yeah,
and that deal fell through, and that didn't help the shares either. So yeah, there's been a lot of activity around Plus 500 the past sort of year or so. But yeah, I can kind of appreciate. Yeah, it is, and I can appreciate why Waymo's maybe getting a little bit more optimistic about it, given the sort of travails that it's already been through.
Indeed. All right.
It's looking very cheap as well.
Okay. Cheap, relative. It's an abstract concept. Thank you, Emma.
You know what I mean.
So, yeah, a few more companies on there that we haven't talked about.
Yeah, we won't go through all of them.
No, we'll be here till next Tuesday. Okay, right, what else have we got in the magazine this week? We've gone through quite a bit of the news, but a bit busy on the results front. A few interesting companies there. A couple that you've covered this week, actually, Bradley. We had GVC, which used to be on AIM.
It did, yeah. It's actually really only kind of graduated. Well, not really only graduated, that's putting it down. I've actually got it as a buy tip. It's graduated largely to the main market because of its recent purchase of BWIN, which is a much larger company. And I think it's basically in the FTSE 250 now, or will be when the review happens.
More retailers, we've got Boohoo, we've got AB Dynamics, which have done really well, and they've done well out of the car industry. As they featured in a feature that we wrote a little while back on how the nature of car technology is changing. Character Group, Peppa Pig effects
and Teletubbies. It's a Character Group is a toy manufacturer, and they sort of quite shrewdly, I suppose, seek out the licenses of certain toy franchises that are it seems, having looked through the results, often linked to sort of successful television runs at the moment, or they've got a deal to make Stretch Armstrong toys.
What
again
on earth is Stretch Armstrong?
It's this, well, apparently Graham knows it very well.
His kids are a bit younger than mine.
Basically, it's just a toy that kind of looks a little bit like Hulk Hogan, but isn't Hulk Hogan. And it just stretches incredibly far. But Netflix is actually in the process of making a series or film about Stretch Armstrong. So obviously, with that happening, people are going to want the toys. So Character Group is quite clever in picking the sort of toy sort of franchises it picks up.
All right.
It's done very well. Simon Thompson's also very keen on the stock.
Okay. Whitbread. I mean, this is a good one. I like the look of this. These results were good, and you know this. This share price has been in the doldrums.
Yeah,
buy an opportunity.
Well, it already was, John. Yeah, I tipped it a little while ago as a buy when the shares. They had a bit of a rough Christmas. Christmas was pretty warm, so obviously the desire to drink a coffee on a warm day is somewhat, you know, depressed. So they had this trading update around sort of January time, I think, and the market didn't take it very well, and they did dip quite a lot. And at that point, I said to Algie, look, I'd like to tip this. I think it's a good point to get back into Whitbread. And thankfully, that's proved right, because the tip is up from, it is admittedly a short time frame, but it is up. And I think even on 16 times now, which has baked a bit of the recovery in, that's not that expensive for something that is such a sort of a stalwart of the market, I suppose. And you know, Premier Inn and Costa Coffee are solid chains, and you can have the discussion, I suppose, about Costa and whether, you know, there are, as I was saying earlier, lots of there's lots of competition in terms of coffee. But what's interesting about Costa is it's internationally growing quite well, and actually its machines, which it puts in things like petrol stations, that business is growing incredibly fast, and the margins on it are very, very good. And I think sometimes when you hear Costa, you don't think about that. You just think about the retail estate and worry about that, but it's a bit more complex than that.
Okay. Now, when I think petrol station coffee, I think Wild Bean Cafe for some reason.
You're obviously stopping in different ones, and there's Wild Bean, there's other ones. But yeah, Costa Coffee has a lot of these sort of instant, well, it's an instant, all right, sort of quick coffee machines. And yeah.
Poland is a big market for them. It which is where I'll be in a month's time, hopefully.
Really?
Yeah, no. Warsaw.
Nice.
What did they buy? It's called Coffee Heaven, I think. Is there a Polish acquisition out?
I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, nice dividend increase there as well. So, yes. Yeah, Whitbread, stick with it.
Absolutely.
All right, and James Norrington has updated his high-yield system. It's a good one, actually. Not performance-wise, but it's a good column. He's managed to bring in some fantastic footballing analogies, which I always appreciate. The usual tips, the usual stock screens and sector focuses, and lots in the comments section, including Alex Newman's first effort at the commodities column, and it's a good one. So thank you very much. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Emma. Pick up the magazine, A100 Part 2. I presume you've already bought Part 1, so you will know that it's £4.70 in all good news agents, and we'll speak again next week. Thank you.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.